Hello, everybody. It's Laura, and I am speaking to you after a fever that's taken my whole family down, including me. Actually, we have two that haven't had it yet, so I'm crossing my cross your fingers for us. But maybe not. I don't know. These fevers are always really transformative, and that's how I feel about this podcast episode with Jordan Walker. First, let me say I am here to introduce the new season on the Divine Feminine and Divine Masculine. And I always say that I'm going to disrupt materialism, but I want to say that in another way just to balance it, because that's what this episode is all about. And that is that I also like to bring to light the most living things in life. And one of them is the divine feminine and the divine masculine within us. So I'm happy to introduce this fifth season of That Good May Become. Thank you so much for being with me and hanging in with me as we, you know, live all the way across the world from where we were, closer to some of you, further from some of you. I so appreciate you listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for reaching out to me. Thank you for asking me when the next episode is coming out. And here it is. So Jordan Walker is a dear friend, and I am thrilled that he said yes to being on this podcast, because this is what I want to say about Jordan. He finds and works with the images and themes of his life and the life around him. And if you happen to be one of his friends, he will do this with you too. And he brings these images and pictures and metaphors together to create a spiritual poetry that offers meaningful questions and ideas to ponder. He just does this, and you'll hear this throughout the podcast. It's really incredible to me, this skill that he has. In this episode, what we really talk about is reconciling the feminine and the masculine, and how that is the work of our life within each of us, and how we do that. The podcast starts out with his recollection of a dream from his childhood that takes him to the abyss. And we talk about the abyss throughout this, and balancing the beauty of life and the beauty of some of the feminine depictions we see in life with the apocalyptic aspects of reality, and what that looks like, what that darkness means, what that light means, how we live in between them, and how that's related to the divine feminine and masculine. I need to apologize for my sound in this podcast, but fortunately, and most importantly, Jordan's sound is absolutely perfect. So I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for being here with me to explore this topic, and thank you for following and liking and sharing the podcast with people. And please stay in touch. Find me at Laura_Scappatici at Instagram, and also you can email me anytime at connect@laurascappatici.com. Thanks for tuning in, and enjoy.
Welcome to That Good May Become with me, Laura Scappatici, where we learn to illuminate the esoteric in our everyday lives.
Jordan, thank you for being here with me today. I'm so happy to, first of all, just be hearing your voice across the ocean. And I just am thrilled that we're going to be talking about the divine feminine and divine masculine and everything else in the world, because it's kind of what we do when we talk. And with your, I've always just been amazed by your creativity and your eloquence and the way that you bring like all your interests together. And you're one of the people in the world that I just see as having this incredible balance of these divine energies. And so I don't know where our conversation will go today, but I'm just delighted that we're getting to have it.
Nice. Yes, I agree. I'm so happy every time I talk with you, Laura.
So I usually start out the podcast just by asking guests, you know, can you talk about a spiritual encounter? And the reason I do that is to sort of, you know, everyone that's listening is used to me saying this, to kind of normalize these spiritual experiences we have and to just bring them to light. And of course, not every spiritual experience is meant to be shared on a podcast, but I feel like it's instructive and helpful and heartening for people to hear some of them and what it's like to live with something in what is, in my experience, super rich and, you know, additive to life. So do you have something you want to share?
Yeah, you know, I knew you were going to ask, so I've thought about it and didn't have one that leapt forward. And so I'll have to choose this exact moment one. But it's interesting because the way they came forward in my mind was as sort of positive spiritual encounters and negative spiritual encounters, which is I think a framing device that I'm working so hard to uncouple myself from, you know, from seeing emotions as positive and negative or experiences or anything. But that, so it was interesting to me that that's how it came forward. And what I think, and then I took interest in that, like, oh, and dug a little deeper. And what I think was under that was frightening. Or experience or encounters that left me uneasy and ones that were very reassuring. So, and it's easy to see where so you could apply positive to the ones that were reassuring of, oh my, I'm loved in such a big way versus being shaken and scared, can easily be, you know, you could apply the, oh, that was a negative experience, or, whoa, I just encountered darkness. So that's kind of what happened when I thought, and inquired about what have my encounters been. But maybe I'll share perhaps my earliest, because maybe it predated or came before I had that lens of saying, oh wow, that was a positive encounter, or this was a negative one. And I think my earliest spiritual encounter, and I can't remember my years actually, it was a reoccurring dream that I would have that was, I would wake from and not be sure if I had just had a nightmare or not. And I know, right? And so, and I think that as these spiritual encounters, they always or often are, they're hard to describe to other people, right? Because it's hard to language it. But especially this, because so I don't know what we're talking about. We're probably talking about 3, 4, 5 even over those years, many times, you know, a dozen or more, I would wake from a dream holding my breath or out of breath. And I knew that feeling from a nightmare, you know, oh my gosh, a wolf was chasing me, or oh my God, I just dreamt that my parents had died or something. I knew that out of breath, but it wasn't a nightmare. So, but yet it also wasn't a pleasant dream where I wanted to snuggle back under the covers and live more of it. And so what it was, and I haven't talked about it in a long time. So, you know, I'm seeing if what the language is, and I guess it was a subjectless immensity. So it's sort of like being at the edge of the ocean on a moonless night, you know, where the waves are and they're so big, and you just know, oh my goodness, this water goes on forever. It was like that, but no ocean, no crashing waves. It was just the feeling of immensity.
Wow.
And And then the scary, so that's already kind of frightening. Like, I remember, you know, like, as I got a little bit older, some images of being in outer space or an astronaut, the way the astronaut, like, will be out there with a little cord in his astronaut suit floating in outer space, and that like fear, oh my gosh, if that cord would break, he would just float off forever and ever and like never hit anything. You know, it was like that was the dream with many, many voices that weren't saying anything discernible. So they weren't words. But there was some kind of, see, I got goosebumps just thinking about it. Yeah, which is just so many voices, like not clicking or whispering exactly, but somehow signaling to me that they were there. So there, and it wasn't hundreds, it wasn't thousands, it wasn't millions, it was like untold number of voices. So that was a big my childhood is having a nightmare that wasn't quite a nightmare, and an experience that there was a spiritual world or something beyond this earth that was so big that it almost like couldn't exist in daylight and in my language to tell my parents what it was, you know.
That's incredible. And what's incredible to me too is that you remember it so well, and that it could give you goosebumps just now, even though you were so young when you heard it. And I feel like at the age I'm at, when I look back on these things and I'm like, why do I remember that with such like there's a spotlight on it. It's so clear and so intense, even in its like recall, that, you know, that impact, you know, is still there. So I appreciate you sharing something like that, because I'm sure many people that are listening, you know, I can think of experiences maybe from that time period that it's just like, why did that stay with me so much? And do you feel like it's connected to your, you know, you kind of said it's connected to something greater than you. Do you feel like it connects to your spiritual practices or outlook on life now, like when you think back to that immensity, I guess?
Yeah, you know, it's just as I was telling that story, a crow or, you know, a black, like almost raven looking bird just landed on the tree directly in front of the window, and is just sitting there just like calling the whole time. And and yeah, it's kind of that same way. Like if it was a red bird or something, I'd be like, oh, a robin, you know, or something. But it's a blackbird. And so, and I think that feeling probably carries through that I had there as that little boy of the immensity, not just being benign, you know, and like and white and angels with harps and white fluffy clouds. There is like a it could swallow you up. I think that's it. That's probably what still stays with me today. While I have an enormously positive and hopeful outlook on life in all ways, and I think underlying that goes back to that first dream of, and this, you know, this blackbird here, of there's something that just asks me to wake up and take it really seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's great. I love that the bird was there too, just to, you know, further reinforce the the image. And I mean, the word that keeps coming to me, and, you know, if I'm going to point back to anthroposophy at all, is the abyss. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I feel like, you know, I didn't understand what that meant I was like, okay, the abyss, and then the guardian, this guardian of the threshold, right? And it's like, it's to me now, I think, my gosh, we could be in the abyss at any situation at any time when we lose our sense of purpose or connection or anything that just tips us over into this space of kind of nothing. And I love that in this dream and with this blackbird, there's like this call to come back. Here I am. Like, come back, step back from that abyss. But something like that. It's always kind of sucks when someone else interprets your dreams, though. So don't.
No. Yeah. No. I think that's it. I think that's now what's that's strongly living for me in this conversation is the presence of the abyss, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, which I think it's good. No, I mean, even good's not the right word, you know, it's accurate, mm-hmm. accurate for us to hold that experience close to us as we make ourselves through a true day, you know, to really live is I think to have that presence close by. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a nice way to put it. Like, as you said, a true day, what does that mean exactly? But it's like when that presence is close, I do feel like it's a true day, you know, like when I have that spiritual sort of sense throughout my day. So let's transition. I think it's really interesting that you talked about these opposites, like, or they felt opposite to you, like the good experiences and the bad experiences. And I feel like that happens where, you know, we see masculine and feminine divided in these, you know, binaries that are all crumbling around us all the time now. And, you know, like I said, I feel like you're a person that embodies these. I don't know. Do you feel like you embody them pretty well? Like, I mean, that's my perception of you.
Yeah. You know, you're not the first person that said that. And I take it as a great compliment. So that there's something there, you know, that other people have recognized that.
And yeah.
I don't know how much I, you know, actively, although what am I talking about? I mean, it is the theme of my whole life. I am super relational and have an older and a younger sister and have been around just, you know, feminine presence my whole life and view relationship as, you know, one of the most important works I'm engaged in. So yes.
I can tell you just own that. That's good. Yeah. And so you had a couple thoughts, like we were kind of voice memoing each other across the sea. And talking about this, I guess my questions, you know, when I wanted to do this season, was just about the balance and the middle space. And, you know, I feel like there was this sort of rise of this divine feminine that we see so many places. And also, the one lifts up the other every time, I think, you know, so that divine masculine as well would always come into the conversation. Like I'd be in a group and I'd say something divine feminine, and always someone would be like, and don't forget divine masculine, right? It's like we need those, and how do we hold them within ourselves, and what does that look like? And, you know, I also have my eldest kiddo is non-binary, using the pronoun they. And it's like, I love how this generation just continues to smash. They just smash all the constructs. And they're like, actually, no, not male, not female, just me, just me, just me here. So, you know, I mean, I just also have that lens of this, you know, kind of abolition of, or, you know, gender and all the things that come along with it. And now, of course, we're not talking about gender right now. We're talking about something past that. Maybe you could just go for it.
Yeah. No, it's so good. Now I have my hands on a couple different books and things like that. So I'm excited about where the conversation goes, because I just pulled up from the beginning there and talking about the abyss and what arose, I remembered this line from such a good poem, I'm sure you love it too, by William Stafford, A Ritual to Read to Each Other, and how it ends. I'm sure you'll kind of recognize it. Mm-hmm. It begins, if you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. And wow. Yeah, right. That's the beginning. That's the way it begins. And it's got great stanzas in between. And then this is how it ends. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep.
There it is, the deep there darkness. Deep, yeah. Darkness.
But that's what you know leapt forward, and then but then you're sharing this about gender and what is arising from this generation that says, like, no, me, all of me, you know, mm-hmm. Let me be clear on this. Let me be clear about the signal we give so that you can understand that I am more than what has been in the past, more than a box that can be easily checked, right? I'm a fuller picture. And that, I think, we're all quaking with that in very different ways, right? We're quaking with a future culture that doesn't bind us to half-truths. And the poets are so good, like the crow out there, you know, of calling us to be more whole. And I think that's also the spiritual path, right? Is whatever that looks like for people, which can be really, really different, but it is a kind of a medicine path of healing what was split apart and seeking to be more whole. So, but this question of polarity is still so useful because we are experiencing, I am experiencing regularly, pleasure and pain, and categorizing it as good and bad. And, you know, and there's something biologically true about gender, which human beings are able to give birth and which don't. So there's so throwing all of that out just makes us less clear, less articulate in being able to describe distinctions that don't define what is whole, what is unable to be separated. And that you do find, almost in order to remain accurate to it, you must move into the realm of poetry or art or something, because by its very nature, you move out of language that is built up out of this, not that, you know?
Yes. Oh my goodness. I feel like, you know, the whole thing about the spiritual alphabet, that's like an anthroposophy thing, right? There's this alphabet it's a spiritual alphabet. And once you've worked with these spiritual concepts, you can read the spiritual alphabet, essentially. And that's like where, you know, like the realm of poetry and art, like they help to define, I would say, that alphabet in a way, or get us, they're like a step towards that understanding, where our words and our constructs fail us so much of the time. And, you know, exactly, we have this generation saying, these fail us. Let us come up with a new alphabet. Let us come up with a new word. Let us come up with, you know, a new picture of what it means to be whole. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that poem. I'll have to make sure I get it from you so I can put it in the show notes.
No, and I think it, as you go through life, they're just continually wake up to these stars that you're following that might, you know, you're like, you're the errors in your navigation chart or something. And I feel like we continually have this choice. Do I recalibrate and like redirect, or do I keep going, even though that I have a suspicion that actually I aligned myself with something that's not quite true, you know, or the highest, or the, you know, the deepest. And as you get older in life, there's like more to lose in recalibrating, especially you do the math back and you're like, oh my God, you know, I've been following this for a long time. So that would mean a lot of backtracking, you know? And what is so incredible about youth is you're in just getting started on your ship, like there's, you know, and there really should be. And if that is education, that's providing a container for youth to say, no problem, like try that star, try that star, try that star, right? And it does become, I have a lot more compassion as I'm making my way through middle age for folks who just are too scared, really too scared to change course, even though they realize, oh my, like this isn't taking me where I'd come to Earth to go.
You know, I love this picture of the star and the changing and how young people like offering them environments where they can try a million things out. Like that is the job of the parent, and exposing them to things so they can find their destiny, right? Mm-hmm. And until I met anthroposophists and other people on different spiritual paths, I didn't know like it was normal or okay to be like, that didn't work out, let me go over here. No, that wasn't quite the right job. Oh yeah, I got this degree, but that's not really working out for me. And then I met anthroposophists and I was like, oh my God, they're all like this. Like I'd meet them and they'd be like, oh, well, for a while we lived in South Africa and then we moved to Hawthorne Valley. And then 6 years later, we decided to go to Germany for a while. Like they would just be all over the place and have all different kinds of iterations of their life. But they were probably following one thing in a way, this inner GPS or whatever you want to call it, this inner navigation to get where they were trying to go. But yeah, I appreciate that non-judgment of folks that are kind of not changing or going or there's fear there. Mm-hmm. And then also the people that haven't judged me for all the jumps and leaps and, you know, grand jetés across the globe that our family has done. So
that metaphor is always like are only accurate from one angle, right? I mean, even this idea that we can ever be on the wrong track is, you know, is itself kind of locked into a certain duality and polarity, right? Because it's not, you know, that and that if this idea that I think is across cultures of a life review that happens upon death, just beautiful, you know, to live into that and be able to be like, oh my, we'll be able to see the crazy path our little ship took across that, you know, that huge abyssful ocean, right? And how beautiful it is, instead of all those jigs and jags that felt at the time like wrong ways and course corrections and everything, you know, to see it truly, which I am definitely very thankful, grateful for this belief that is definitely my operating hypothesis that I will, that at some point, you know, that the truest part of me will be able to see all that and put it into context and be able to see how beautifully guided and perfect it was the whole time. Even while in the ship, it felt very jiggity and jaggedy.
Yeah, yeah, the waves, the bumps, the storms, the turning around and turning back. Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's so nice. So I guess in terms of divine feminine and masculine in this process, and please just like jump back or jump forward or do whatever you'd like during this podcast, because I might steer us somewhere that you were like, wait, I thought we were going over here. But I often think of these concepts in terms of direction in a way, and leadership, and how they evidence themselves differently. So for example, like even in my house, it could sort of be the conversation could go something like this, like, hey, let's go somewhere on this amazing continent this weekend. Okay. Yeah. Let's go somewhere. And I'll be like, I've heard about this place and it seems pretty cool. And then my husband will be like, let's look it up. And then, you know, so I'll be having this like intuitive sense, like, let's get ourselves to London on this date because for whatever, I don't know why. And he's like, okay, getting in there and figuring out the details. This is kind of a stupid example. But, you know, in leadership, the same thing with structure and with intuition and with sort of an almost like an unseen guidance. You said a couple of things on that voice memo where you were talking about like the Madonna and how, and the constructs around that, and how it's often depicted. I want you to talk about it. So I don't know if you can launch from what I just said into what you said on that voice memo about the Madonna.
Yeah,
but I feel like there's a connection there. And if anyone can find it, Jordan, it's you. I know you can.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely a direct connection. You know, and well, I mean, and it is reconciling this polarity that we experience everywhere in life, right? Of in which masculine and feminine are just one example. But as you say, sort of the fact-based logistics of causal intelligence, you know, that's something like like flight schedules operate on, right? Otherwise we'd have a very different world if we weren't like arriving at a certain time expecting something to be there to meet us because it had been written weeks before. And this intuition and, you know, which things like synchronicity and all of that happened where you arrive and something absolutely unscheduled arrives, but yet there's a feeling of its purposefulness and its meaningfulness. But yet, you know, to the outer world, it can look totally random because it wasn't on any schedule anywhere. So the fact that they need a name. You call them whatever you want, but they are so inherent to being human that they must be given their own sphere and their own space, you know, and be made sense of, even if you only value one and discount the other, at least consciously discount it because you and recognize that it is something. It is something that you are choosing to ignore. And of course, you and I and people who are questing for wholeness don't want to ignore anything. You know, every time I catch sight of some aspect of my reality that I've left out of acknowledgement, you know, I increasingly like, I can feel right now, I actually feel a softening and a sadness in my heart. Like a person on the street who others are like who I am tempted to step over like others are doing, right? It's like some aspect of my reality I'm stepping over because the list can be long why. You know, I don't have language for it. I can't quite make sense of it. I'm in a hurry to go to this other place, this other way of being, right? But and so not even blaming myself for doing that, but if I have the time and the space, I'm going to stop and I'm even going to hunker down and say, what part of my reality have I not gotten to know? And in that way, I think we do arrive back at something I was thinking about is shadow. And certainly in sort of archetypal psychology and depth psychology, there's this concept that I'm sure many folks listening to this are aware of, is that there's preferred aspects of ourself, and then there's unacknowledged and repressed, unintegrated aspects of ourself. And in order to be whole and in order to even find peace and to kind of authentically be present for whatever is arriving looking for a relationship with us, that we can't keep operating out of a preference for the shiny parts and a repression of the dark parts. And I feel like there's actually, for me personally right now, some correspondence between the masculine and the feminine there. And I recognize that when we're talking in anthroposophy about the divine feminine or Sophia, is that we're actually often holding up very illuminated, shiny parts, you know, or beings, right, descending from the clouds. Literally, the Madonnas, which are certainly sacred iconography, but this Blessed Virgin Mary has a lot in common with the illuminated Christ or the illuminated saints, a lot of light, a lot of goodness, a lot of purity. And so other than that one has breasts and one doesn't or something, they're carrying for me a very similar spiritual energy. Mm-hmm. And what can be missing from that iconography is this abyss, is the apocalyptic aspect of reality, the vengeful and angry aspect of reality, the dark and scary aspects of myself, the reality that I need. And so when you see other traditions, you know, like the Hindu sort of goddesses there, right? Kali, who's all that blood and daggers and stuff, and there's can really be a contrast to our tradition, which would say that's the sinful unholy parts. But yet in any indigenous kind of cosmology, you're going to make all aspects of reality divine. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is something that I'm personally looking for is how, in this case, feminine is actually what I'm really feeling personally, is what aspects of this veiled, because Rudolf Steiner in Anthroposophy speaks quite a lot about the veiling of this Isis, Sophia, feminine archetype. And holding up a Raphael Madonna doesn't feel to me like it's actually lifting the veil. Feels like it's in a way materializing, or it's a maybe even spiritual bypass, to say it strongly, you know. It is what, and it's personal, like what is veiled in my experience, and what does it look like to lift the veil, and there's trepidation, like that early childhood dream, you know, there's trepidation of spending too long in the abyss. What are those voices saying? Who am I? Where am I in this? And yet hanging out there is what I feel like the mystics and the mystery traditions are really asking for when they speak about dying before you die. That's not a pretty light-filled scenario. That's a little bit closer to that Kali, blood dripping skulls and daggers sort of experience. And so can I, befriend that goddess as well as the one descending from heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. You know, I just keep picturing birth and all the blood and the screaming. At least that's how it was in my house. And, you know, the intensity of it. And some people, I think, have a very transcendent birth experience, but it's intense no matter what. Like, and that has, you know, out of the darkness of the womb, right? It's an intensity and a darkness and a shadow that isn't to be overcome. It's to be lived with. It's kind of what I hear you saying. It's like, how do we live with that? All the mess and all the intensity and all the darkness and see it as not bad or good. And instead of just thinking, let me rise out and escape this body and just look to the heavens and aim for the halo, you know? And they're both, it's that in between space that they're both needed, you know, what's the halo on earth kind of thing and the blood in heaven, you know, it's like, how do these things meet? So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, it's the being in that little boat, right? With your eye, the stars are mm-hmm. so important. You are being navigated by the saints and the spiritual ideals and the spiritual knowledge in anthroposophy is such a gift to navigate by. And I'm in this little boat with massive waves, you know, all around that will swallow me up. And to forget that and to only, you know, be in the heavens is to actually be forsaking so much of the human experience, right? And then also I can feel so much compassion for someone in the boat that hasn't been given the stars to navigate by, right? Mm-hmm. But that whole experience is I think reconciling this masculine and feminine, and so and gender for many of us like does point the way towards a way that culture is going to educate us, but also even maybe just a disposition towards one pole or the other, but that the life journey is going to be about reconciling the weaker parts too, right? Or the less seen or less appreciated parts. And so for the very logistical, practically minded person, it is accessing and finding and relying on the intuitive. And for that very sensitive, intuitive person, it is about being able to trust themselves logistically in this world and being able to navigate that those concrete parts. And I think we recognize someone who is doing that work. We recognize somebody who is developing their less developed side. And that always fills me with so much inspiration. And it can look so different for someone else, right? It can mm-hmm. know this from doing so much social work is how it feels when the quiet person in the group who has been hanging back, like stands up and their voice is quivering and they offer something to the group, right? It's like, boom, it's such medicine for the group. And likewise, it's so good when that type A person like actually stays in their chair and lets her speak, right? And actually gives space for someone else to step up and be the leader or the, you know, or the talkative one or whatever, right? They're so powerful because not because of what happened, but because of who it was that was letting it happen.
Right? Mm, yeah, that's so true. I mean, I don't know. It always feels like a miracle for me if I don't say anything for an entire session of something. I'm like, good job. But, you know, you're right. Like it's and it is so beautiful when that quiet allows someone quiet to step in and be heard. So I love that. Like it's the quest of our life to kind of balance these things. And I think sometimes the culture we are in makes it harder and sometimes it makes it easier. And I feel like right now it's trying to make it easier for humans to have this divine feminine awareness and connection And, you know, you see it on in the bookshelves at any yeah. bookstore and in, you know, on Instagram and kind of anywhere you look. And with Stephanie Georgia, I just interviewed her actually about the Black Madonna, and that's like a Madonna that's really connected to the earth and what that means. So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it makes me, you're just talking about the bookshelves. Last night, I put my hand on this book, Love and the World by Robert Sardello. It is such a special book. I read it many years ago, and I'm so excited to, it's like meeting an old friend, you know? You're like, oh my gosh, this one's so perfect for now, the moment. And just in the beginning, he is touching on kind of what we're talking about. I think when he says, much of the world is in total confusion because we are being asked to develop this new capacity of living through conscious loving for the first time. And he goes about, I mean, what the book is actually speaking about a new love for the consciousness soul, which is the, you know, anthroposophical understanding of where we are developing into. Mm-hmm. And so it's so future oriented. And so it's the same word, right, that we now have many hundreds of years of kind of working with. But even that is amazing, you know, that it's only been, what, I don't have it at the top, you know, like what, the 14th century or since romantic love, it comes on the scene, you know, it's really been a recent addition to our experience, what all the pop songs are filled with, or what all the pop songs used to be filled with. Because now, if you really listen, which I like to do every now and then, to what young people are, what's moving them, what's moving their soul, there's a lot more nuanced, to put it one way, you know, a lot more darkness, a lot more tension and angst and complication in surrounding what, you know, in the 50s or 60s was pretty straightforward, you know. Yep. Boy sees girl, girl likes boy, you know, they are in love. And now the world is in crisis because, you know, an anthroposophy offers an explanation why things are the way they are. It doesn't offer, a get out of jail free card. And as far as knowing how I am personally going to navigate this crisis, but it does explain why the world is in crisis, is because there's never been this need before. I can't look to the past to figure out how to navigate what the divine masculine looks like and what the divine feminine should be and who should be what. That's never been before, but yet my coordinates, you know, be on love. That's that rings true from all the pop songs, past and present and future, is that somehow love is the reason, you know, is the reason for all the confusion, all the tension, all the magnetism, all the repulsion, all of that. It's about love. And then, you know, and then I'm called to like look for who talks about love well, who displays and participates in love well, and those are going to be the people who I navigate by, or the poems or stories I navigate by are ones who are really teaching me how to love more and love more truly.
Yeah, that's so great. And I mean, how can we not navigate towards that? And you know what the thing is, I think, and I remember this from Applied Anthroposophy, we were trying to figure out like these four key concepts. Freedom came before love. I had love first. And someone, Nathaniel Williams, actually very directly said, I think you should change the order. It's freedom, then love, then, you know, and that's what I see again. I thank you, Jen, whatever you are now, Z. the one, the Jen Alpha, I think is the one that's coming up now. That my, oh, yeah. I think your kids are Alpha, which is such a funny name, right? But
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, but they, and I just had a discussion with my husband about this. They are like redefining everything. And I do feel like some of the labels, sorry for all of you listening who may disagree with me. I feel like the labels are a box in a way, but the labels are also an attempt at freedom. So they're like, no, I'm ace. No, I'm this romance, but not sex. I'm this, like they just keep like coming up with all these different terms, but it's in an effort to find freedom in love. So they won't settle for, you know, the traditional, any kind of traditional box. They're like, no, actually, we're going to create our own boxes, in my opinion. But these are freer. And the way that we've defined these things has, even though they are defined, they've broken the original huge box that everybody was kind of in around marriage and gender and how families come about and all kinds of things. So I love that freedom is a precondition to love in this situation. Now, you know, freedom's like a, you know, trigger word for people, especially in the United States, but we can talk about freedom on another episode, Jordan. What do you think about that?
That's a big one. But I think, again, it's so helpful. As you say, it's a trigger. And what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? But to define, which, and of course, anthroposophy is not the only way, you know, to define your terms. But I think in this is what a community of seekers, whether that, and in the past, that was, of course, in a religious tradition, and it still is for some, but increasingly there's people who are finding that they want to describe and investigate and research in their own life these the most important things, like freedom and love, right? I mean, these are the most foundational, and it's very difficult unless you have a common understanding of what you mean by freedom. What do I mean by freedom? And you see this in the difficulties that the country, I think, is currently having with being able to have discourse around them, is that there's these, the definitions are so varied of what people mean by the different words. So therefore, we're literally speaking different languages. Mm-hmm. And you can either, and people do, you know, you do the good work of really getting in there and understanding what someone else means by the word they're using. But what I often find is that I actually am not clear, or you aren't clear, because you've never actually examined it before. Mm-hmm. You've been using it, and that's this whole echo chamber kind of phenomena of you don't need to define it, because you at least think that everybody on your whatever, your Facebook feed or whatever, has the same definition of you. And so hitting up against this failure of communication, hopefully this is the silver lining, wakes us up to the need to actually arrive at a definition or a working definition of what I mean by this word. And then of course the power of asking someone else a question of what's your understanding when you're speaking about freedom, what do you mean? And therefore, you're at least waking up the fact that you don't have a good, well, are my cult, my education, my culture, my whatever didn't give me deep enough or satisfying enough definitions of what these things mean. Like the, you know, the confusion between gender and polarity, or, you know, the masculine and the feminine already there. It's been so helpful just really in the last, 50 years or something, that we've been able to stick divine before we say masculine or divine. So therefore, you know, broken open. And now we're just breaking open these terms so much, and something like anthroposophy and all, I would say, all the mystery traditions go deep enough that they provide like actually solid footing, a real foundation for reading the philosophy of freedom or the philosophy of spiritual activity is definitely not an easy ride for anybody. And
no,
don't think anytime soon it's going to become a bestseller. But when one does it, I found myself all of a sudden down deep enough that I was on some sort of bedrock in relation to that one concept, that one word, freedom. And then, you know, and since then, over the last 17 years or so, I would say I've been building, often in very rickety ways, but building structures up from that. But I have to say, my definition of freedom is, you know, is based on something, mm-hmm. because what anthroposophy, you know, provided in that way. And then now I feel like I am, every time I turn to these books, you know, like right now with where I am in my life, I read Rumi just as if for the first time, you know, and this is a bestseller, right?
Yeah.
Rumi is available for everybody. You know, listen to this, listen. Let love, the water of life, flow through our veins. Let a love-drunk mirror, steeped in the wine of dawn, translate night. You who pour the wine, put the cup of oneness in my hand, and let me drink from it until I can't imagine separation. Love, you are the archer. My mind is your prey. Carry my heart and make my existence your bullseye.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, it says, put the cup of oneness in my hand. So you who pour the wine, first of all, there's others involved in this process here, right? I don't have all the pieces. So you who pour the wine, put the cup of oneness in my hand. Let me drink from it until I can't imagine separation. Like that's, you know, that's all I want for myself. And it's all I want for my 4 and 8-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. And anyone who I love, I want to bring that cup around and include, and as my love grows and I'm able to incorporate more of who I thought was different and unworthy and all of the more I can't imagine any separation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Any unworthiness, any, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground and I want people to digest it. And I want to ask though, is there anything that you didn't get to share that you want to share before we conclude our time?
Yeah, I mean, I love where we went. You know, maybe for the show notes, you know, I have some thoughts that spring to mind as far as like really good resources. So
yeah,
I'll just
please
mention Robert Johnson, mm-hmm. I wonder if he's still living. I would really love to seek him out. He feels like a real friend. Mm-hmm. His little books, and they're very accessible. And I call them little because they're somehow so clear and essentialized. And he has a book called He, one called She, one called We, and then the book that's right in my hands right now is called Owning Your Own Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the dark side of the psyche. So he's working out of the Jungian, yes, kind of psychology tradition. And I would really just highly recommend those books for anybody who looks at them through kind of a mythological lens. And I think they are so helpful, just incredibly practical to working with he and she and we. Yeah.
Thanks, Jordan. I want to tell you, you know, we would sometimes have these calls with our friend Angela, and at the end, you would kind of end up creating some sort of poem from the call. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just make this a little, this isn't really a poem, but I've learned about this concept in my writing program about thematic architecture. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to point out some of the thematic architecture of our podcast and the things that came up. And what's remarkable to me, and it's always remarkable to me when I speak with you, and this happens in containers of people, like containers is a weird word probably, but hopefully everybody knows what I mean. In these, in certain configurations of people, something just comes through, and the entire day before I talked with you, the themes that were in this podcast that you brought were themes I was working with in my life. So I'm just going to read them. So some of our thematic architecture from our podcast, Jordan, had to do with the sea between us, the water and the boat, the darkness, the abyss, the night, and then the stars as we look up and see that that light above us. And the polarity between the space between those polarities, between the darkness of the sea and the brightness of the star, and where we live in there. I'm so grateful for our conversation. Thank you for being here with me and talking through all this amazing, all your amazing ideas.
Yeah, thank you so much, Laura. Thank you for the way that you hold space for conversation and the way that you delight and light up in learning and in speaking about what's really important.
Thank you. We'll talk again soon.
Yes, absolutely.